You're listening to KMUN News. I'm Skylar Butenchin. It's Thursday, March 12th. The Washington Cascades were under a winter weather advisory and blizzard warning yesterday. The new powder has skiers rejoicing, but this winter has been so dismal for snow that scientists say it would take a whole month of heavy snowfall to end the state's snow drought. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
The forecasts are staggering. 3 to 6 feet of new snow at Stevens Pass this week, 9 to 15 feet at Paradise on Mount Rainier. The snow is a welcome addition for a snowpack at some of its lowest levels on record due to an unusually warm winter. Mountain Snowpack is the Northwest's big water tower. It stores water for streams and salmon, farmers and hydropower dams for later in the year. Yet this winter's drought is too severe for a few days of heavy snowfall to undo. And starting on Monday, an atmospheric river of warm rain is expected to hit the state. That could melt away much of this week's fresh snow. If that atmospheric river arrives as expected, it could mean more flooding for Washington. I'm John Ryan reporting.
From Wenatchee, Washington to Owyhee, Oregon, farmers and ranchers are making tough choices about water. Poor winter snowpack throughout the region is to blame. They're all looking at a dry spring, summer, and fall irrigation season. NWPB's senior correspondent Anna King has more.
Scott Ravel isn't happy. He's the manager of the Rosa Irrigation District. This year's water forecast in the Yakima Basin is just 44% of normal for junior water right holders. That means many crops could go fallow or could be ripped out. A lot of families here have been farming for decades.
Nobody wants to be the generation when it all comes unraveled, but they're dealing with market forces and incredibly high input costs, things that are so far beyond the control of anything they can influence off the farm.
In Oregon, ranchers are predicting higher hay prices. There's little snowmelt to feed their alfalfa crops. I'm Anna King.
A proposed income tax on millionaires passed a historic milestone on Tuesday after a marathon debate in the Washington State House. Sarah Mises-Tan has this report.
Democratic lawmakers were ecstatic as the final vote was tallied. Governor Bob Ferguson shook hands with House Speaker Lori Jenkins and Representative April Berg, who had brought the revised version of the tax bill to the floor 25 hours earlier.
You know, it's not too often in this line of work that you have a vote that's truly historic. And by any definition, that's what this was.
Democrats say the revenue from the income tax will be critical. They earmarked funds for childcare and education. Republicans protested with dozens of amendments and warned of a dangerous precedent with the upending of a nearly century-old tax structure. The Senate is expected to quickly agree to the House changes and send the bill to Governor Ferguson to sign. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
Earlier this week, it was announced that the city of Warrenton will receive $4 million in state funding for construction of its new wastewater treatment plant, which is expected to break ground this year. The plant's cost estimate is more than $35 million, but Warrenton voters approved a $12.5 million bond for the project in November, and the city has been saving funds for years. Warrenton's current wastewater treatment plant went online 20 years ago. It first reached capacity in 2015, and since then, it has exceeded its maximum daily load rating at least 11 times. City Manager Esther Moberg says State Representative Cyrus Javity and State Senator Suzanne Weber were crucial in securing the funding. Warrenton is the fastest-growing city in Clatsop County and the largest by area. Mayor Henry Balensiefer says that if a new treatment facility isn't online by 2029, the city could have to initiate a development moratorium due to wastewater treatment capacity. This story comes to us from the Columbia Press. The city of Olympia is now the first city in Washington to offer legal protections for people in polyamorous relationships, and other cities may soon follow. KNKX Murrow News Fellow Nate Sanford has more.
Studies suggest that about 5% of Americans currently practice some type of consensual non-monogamy. That often means they have multiple romantic partners who know about each other and are cool with it. Jessa Davis is the executive director of the Seattle Coalition for Relationship Equity. She says people with non-traditional family structures often feel pressure to keep it hidden.
Mostly because of the stigma, but that stigma can also then translate into real material hardships in their lives.
Davis's group pushed for the new protections in Olympia. The two new laws adopted unanimously by the city council add diverse family and relationship structures to the city's unfair housing code and to the city's anti-discrimination law.
We're not coming for anyone. We're not forcing anyone to be polyamorous. You know, it is literally just saying let people live and let live in their own lives.
Davis says she's been talking with Seattle City Council members about passing similar legislation in the coming weeks or months. Nate Sanford, reporting.
A Marion County judge will decide this week whether to block Oregon state lawmakers from speeding up a vote on gas tax and fee increases. Dirk Vanderhart reports.
Voters were set to approve or reject the tax and fee hikes in November after a grassroots campaign forced them to a vote. Democratic lawmakers changed the election date to May in the recently completed legislative session. The question before Marion County Senior Judge David Leith is whether that was allowed. Oregon's constitution gives lawmakers explicit power to set the date of referendum elections, as they did in this case. Lawyers for Secretary of State Tobias Reed, a defendant in the case, say that's what matters. But plaintiffs say that legislative power is not unlimited. They argue that lawmakers are not allowed to change the date of an election once it's already been certified for a specific ballot. And they argue setting the election for May effectively blocked citizens from being able to offer statements in the voters' pamphlet. Lee said he would rule Wednesday on whether to block the date change. An appeal is likely. In Salem, I'm Dirk Vanderhart reporting.
Western snowy plover nesting season officially begins this Sunday, March 15th, and runs through September 15th. Beachgoers can help recovery efforts for the threatened shorebird by observing recreation restrictions and maps at designated plover beaches. Western snowy plovers nest in dry sand above the high tide line and are often difficult to see because they camouflage well. Populations have been steadily increasing due to ongoing efforts. In sensitive designated nesting areas, beachgoers should stay on wet sand and keep dogs on leashes. This is KMUN. Last week, during their opening match of the AFC Asia Cup football tournament, Iran's women's football team refused to sing the national anthem. The move was seen as an act of defiance, as it came shortly after American and Israeli strikes had killed Iran's supreme leader. The players were subsequently called wartime traitors on Iranian state television. After being knocked out of the tournament on Sunday, several players decided to stay in Australia. Despite heavy surveillance from Iranian authorities, they escaped their hotel and were issued humanitarian visas by the Australian government. This episode of What in the World from BBC explains why the players took this action and the consequences the decision may have for them and their families. We also find out more about the significance of football to Iran's leaders.
Save our girls! Save our girls!
Those are protesters chanting, "Save our girls," as the Iranian women's football team left their hotel in Australia's Gold Coast. They were boarding a bus that would take them to the airport for a flight back to Iran. It's been reported some of the protesters were trying to stop the players getting on the bus. And it's moments like these that have captured the world's attention. Because when Iran's women's football team refused to sing their national anthem in their opening match at the Asian Cup, it was a life-changing decision and led to a lot of concern from across the world that they might face punishment if they go back to Iran. Not all of the players were on the bus. Several had already escaped the hotel after their final match on Sunday and were given visas to stay in the country. Among the players who were on the bus, some had their hands over their ears. So, in this episode, we're going to explain the story of Iran's women's football team, talk you through the twists and turns of what's happened so far, how their decisions might affect their family back home, and why football is an important symbol for Iran. I'm Ikra. This is What's in the World from the BBC World Service. Let's start from the beginning. Iran's women's football team arrived in Australia for the AFC Asian Cup football tournament in February. They were among 12 teams from across Asia competing for a place in the World Cup. The stakes of the tournament and what it meant for Iran were raised pretty quickly. Shortly after the team's arrival, the US and Israel began strikes on Iran. And so people began focusing on the team for totally different reasons. Less about the football, more about the politics. Football is hugely important for Iran, not just for the fans, but also for the government. This is Gonchia Habibyazad from the BBC's Persian service. She's been coming on the podcast throughout the war to keep us updated. And just to fill you in a bit, BBC Persian is the Persian language service of BBC News. It's used by 24 million people around the world, most of them in Iran, even though they're often blocked by Iranian authorities.
Football is really important to people in Iran, and the Iranian establishment views national teams as soldiers of the Islamic Republic for them to project like their legitimacy and show that they're united and they're loyal to Iran despite everything that might happen. And it's a form of like ideology as well for them. Women who participate in sports like abroad, they have to observe mandatory hijab rule, and that kind of projects that outside Iran's borders, these women are still under the rule of the establishment.
During the team's opening match against South Korea last week, the players refused to sing the national anthem. Not singing the anthem is a big deal for any country, but in the current climate, with Iran at war, it's even more significant. I asked Gonchia if the players explained why they didn't sing it.
The silence was an act of civil disobedience itself against the establishment. And this took place just days after the strikes on Iran by the US and Israel on 28 Feb, which led to the death of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei.
So how has the Iranian government reacted?
So the reaction from state TV was that one conservative commentator in Iran accused them of being wartime traitors and called for harsh punishment against them. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson and general prosecutor have said that the team is invited to return home with what they have said is peace and confidence. But we don't know what their fate will be if they return home. Activists and members of the Iranian diaspora have praised the gesture as courageous and had called on Australian authorities to give them asylum.
The team was eliminated from the tournament on Sunday night after losing their third straight match. They were being tightly monitored in the hotel.
The players were reportedly not able to walk around the hotel unaccompanied and were escorted to conference room to eat meals. According to a source who spoke to Australian broadcaster SBS News. And Iranian outlets outside Iran have reported that they were under surveillance and couldn't move freely.
Despite being under watch, five players managed to escape their hotel that evening. The details of how they got out of the hotel and where they went remain a mystery. The BBC's Australia correspondent was in the lobby of the players' hotel when their minders noticed they were missing. And footage shows those minders running down the stairs and into a car parking area trying to find the players. You can hear people with Australian accents mocking them and telling them to leave the country.
You better run! Yeah, you've got no rights here! You're in Australia!
Soon after we found out those five players had escaped from their hotel room, we heard about them receiving humanitarian visas from the Australian government. These visas grant permanent protection to people who face significant human rights violations abroad. It allows them to live, work, and study in Australia. The country's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, had this message for the team's other players.
We're willing to provide assistance to other women in the team, noting that this is a very delicate situation and it is up to them. But we say to them, if you want our help, help is here.
The decision to stay in Australia could put their families in Iran at risk. That may have put off some of the other players from taking up the Prime Minister's offer.
Human rights groups have warned that the authorities sometimes question or detain family members and restrict employment or travel, pressure families to persuade athletes to return. And in BBC Persian, we have seen reports that the families of those who decided to defect have been under pressure inside the country in the past cases.
And now let's get back to where we started. The protest outside of the players' hotel on Tuesday as they left for the airport. The protesters were worried about the consequences that the women might face for not singing the national anthem. So I asked Goncha to describe those consequences.
It can have like a very broad range. It can include interrogation, ban from sport, legal charges such as treason. And in some extreme cases, it can include prison sentences for them as well. We are seeing messages by the authorities saying that they're welcomed back, but they're having cases of people who have returned back to Iran after speaking out against the establishment and they have been imprisoned.
And what have the players and their coaches said?
We have heard some words from them, but we don't know under what circumstances and what situations they were saying these. The head of the team had said that we have so much worries about our families and the people of Iran and nobody likes war. We are very happy that we have a country that people are united and support each other and we really love them and we really will try to make them proud of us.
Since recording our chat with Goncha, we found out at least two more members of the group, a player and one of the support staff, made a last-minute decision to stay in Australia before the rest of the team boarded a bus to the airport. However, one of those women had a change of heart. No official reason has been given. Our Australia correspondent says that activists told the BBC they believe the Iranian regime warned of consequences for her family if she decided to stay. Once she decided to return, she was advised by teammates who were already on their way home that she should contact the Iranian embassy to be collected. And in doing so, she revealed the whereabouts of other players who are staying in Australia. They have since been moved to a different location. Thank you for listening to this episode. We've been keeping our coverage of the US-Israeli war with Iran going. So we have episodes including how Iranians are feeling, why the Strait of Hormuz matters to all of us, and who the new supreme leader of Iran is. You can search for those wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Type in "What in the World" into the search box and you'll find them. But for now, I'm Ikra. This is What in the World from the BBC World Service. I'll see you soon.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In the 2024 election, mail-in ballots accounted for 30.3% of votes cast. So why is the Trump administration throwing everything at the wall to end it before the 2026 midterms? President Trump continues to claim, without evidence, that mail-in voting contributed to widespread fraud in the 2020 and subsequent elections. A more likely reason for eliminating mail ballots? Polling shows 83% of Democrats support mail-in voting, but only 32% of Republicans, according to Pew Research. In March 2025, Trump's executive order on elections mandated mail-in ballots to be received on or before Election Day. The SAVE Act, now before the U.S. Senate, goes further, eliminating universal and no-excuse absentee and allowing only excuse-required absentee ballots. It would also eliminate ballot drop boxes, where in 2024, voters returned 15 million ballots in 36 states. A draft executive order declaring a national emergency, recently floated by election denier activists, had similar provisions. Despite the baseless bluster on mail-in ballots, the Save America Act is unlikely to pass the U.S. Senate. Trump's March 2025 order has been largely neutralized because the president has no jurisdiction over elections, as would any election restrictions using a national emergency declaration as a pretext. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN News team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchen, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.